gains. Many in the military viewed this as a CIA intrusion on their turf. Lawyers from the White House, Justice, DOD, and the CIA wrestled over a multitude of issues. Finally, Clark, Tenet, Allen, and Black carried the day. Rich and I watched from our operational vantage point, witnessing firsthand covert action politics in Washington. It was about money, authority, and power. It was also about risk. Who would take it and who would not? The decision was made. We would arm the Predator. Now the task fell to Rich, Alec, and their team to develop this new tool of war. What type of weapon could be strapped to a Predator? What could be delivered with precision? How could we combine sensor and shooter into a single system? How could we merge intelligence and war? Alec argued for a bomb, something equivalent to a cruise missile in kinetic power, to destroy the AQ command-control communications hubs that CTC had identified. But technically, it would not work. Moreover, the Air Force had no weapon system that met CTC's requirements for the Predator. Rich and Alec consulted with CIA specialists, including a quiet older lady who was probably somebody's grandmother. She was also an expert in terminal ballistics. She calmly explained the effects of overpressure and fragmentation. She supplemented her instruction with PowerPoint presentations depicting the kill range of certain warheads. Alec and his crew called them bug splat slides. They affectionately dubbed her the Black Widow. The options for munitions dwindled to one, the Hellfire missile. Developed for attack helicopters operating against ground-based armored vehicles, the missile had proven itself in combat during the last 15 years. It weighed just over 100 pounds and could be slung under each wing of the Predator. The 20-pound warhead was deemed adequate for fixed targets, such as specific rooms, vehicles, and anti-personnel missions. But the Hellfire was not an Air Force weapon. The Army owned it. This created another set of challenges. By then, December 2000, winter storms had degraded flight time, so we recalled the birds to the United States for reconfiguration and testing with the Hellfire. Because of the Army's ownership, Rich and Alec turned to the Army's Redstone Arsenal, where they discovered a mechanical engineer in love with explosives. Aptly nicknamed Chuck Boom Boom Vessels, combined his passion with a keen intellect sharpened at MIT, where, as a Sloan Fellow, he earned master's degrees in science management and business administration. Working with the U.S. Air Force, Boom Boom figured out the best Hellfire configuration with what appeared to be gleeful ease. When I first met him, I thought he could easily be mistaken for a shade tree mechanic or a hunting guide, given his obvious woodsy manner. At a cultural level, he and I immediately understood each other. Technically, he lost me after a couple of minutes. But I could appreciate the basics and his confidence. There was no doubt the Hellfire would work. Boom Boom often proclaimed, "I have never faced a problem that could not be solved with an appropriate amount of explosives." The U.S. Air Force had scheduled tests for armed UAVs in 2004-2005, but at the CIA's request, they accelerated the program. General John Jumper had been the Air Force champion for this technology. His vision and leadership played a critical role in advancing our program. On 16 and 21 February 2001, at a classified U.S. Air Force base, the first test shots were on target. In the decade to come, UAS would proliferate as a collection tool and often a weapons platform. By 2011, some pundits, in a vigorous defense of President Obama's employment of armed predators, noted that drone attacks have become a centerpiece of national security policy. Some experts would proclaim the armed predator the most accurate weapon in the history of war. In 2001, we had no idea that would be the case. We just wanted verification of our human, a way to employ our intelligence, and to eliminate UBL. In only a few months, Rich, Alec, and their bunch of mission-driven bureaucratic subversives, operating inside the huge and lumbering U.S. security establishment, had imagined and produced an armed UAV. To succeed, these operatives also relied on the interagency leadership of a visionary Air Force general, a brash White House counterterrorism czar, an aggressive Pentagon admiral, a tough assistant director of Central Intelligence, ADCI, and the CIA's counterterrorism chief. They had strapped an Army weapon onto an Air Force platform under command of the CIA. But the political fight immediately became more difficult when DOD and CIA leadership realized what CTC had in its possession. DOD wanted control. This was now an instrument of war, which was DOD's purview, they claimed. Some CIA leaders, such as Pavitt, wanted DOD to take the armed bird. Why should CIA take the risk? In one meeting, Pavitt proclaimed that he was not in the assassination business and he wanted nothing to do with the Predator. Allen, Kofor, Rich, and I argued in favor of keeping the weapon system, which depended entirely on our intelligence. And frankly, we wanted to be the ones to destroy Al-Qaeda. That was our job, a job that nobody else seemed to want. We needed every tool we could claim. The White House ruled. CTC would keep it. But this did not end the acrimonious interagency spat about who had the authority to pull the trigger. CIA had certain lethal authorities assigned by the president, but DOD pushed back, saying that they had greater authority. The lawyers debated. Finally, policy leaders decided that CIA staff officers, at a minimum, needed to have the capability. Alec, who had converted to CIA staff by then, and others in CTC, trained on the system, mastering the targeting protocols. Training included tabletop exercises in Director Tenet's conference room. They learned how to operate the toggle that launched the Hellfire missiles. They called the toggle a monkey switch, because even a monkey could operate it. The bureaucratic squabble over control of the monkey switch continued until 9/11, when President Bush gave it to CIA. The Predator continued to patrol the skies in Afghanistan during the spring and summer of 2001, but there was never another clear sighting of UBL. The Predator, outfitted with a variety of sensors, boosted our intelligence about AQ and the Taliban, including their order of battle and their command-control communication systems. We also increased our SIGINT capabilities. All this technical collection complemented our expanding HUMINT networks. By September 2001, CTC had more than 100 human sources operating in Afghanistan in every province and tribe. This included penetrations of the Taliban and the support networks for AQ. We had unarmed and armed Predators in the air. We had other technical collection systems in place. We knew Afghanistan, friend and foe. With the scope and integration of technical and human sources, we would be ready. Deployment curtailed. Since September 1999, Kofor, Rich, and I had directed a series of missions into Afghanistan's Panjshir Valley, a twisted ribbon of land between near-vertical mountain flanks, where our ally, Ahmed Shah Massoud, and his northern alliance ruled. The mouth of the Panjshir Valley opened onto the Somali Plains, which extended 40 miles south to Kabul. Rich had taken the first team into the Panjshir. We needed to deepen and expand our networks inside Afghanistan. We designed each deployment to boost our assistance, build more trust with our Afghan allies, and gain greater understanding of Al-Qaeda with more advanced HUMINT and SIGINT operations. I had traveled throughout Central Asia along the Afghanistan borders on the north and the east, but had never crossed into Afghanistan. It was time for me to go, to meet with our Afghan allies on their turf, to better understand our mission and our collective needs. I would be the most senior-ranking CIA officer to visit Afghanistan in a decade. I wanted Greg, with his paramilitary skills and great leadership, with me. We planned to depart in September 2000. In early August, Greg and I assembled a team of 8 for a week of intense refresher tactical training. We got a full dose of land navigation, combat first aid, foreign weapons familiarization, driving, crashing, and shooting. Our training emphasized the avoidance of conflict and, if attacked or trapped, self-defense. We emphasized stealth, and when that failed, we concentrated on getting out of trouble. We trained with lethal force to protect ourselves and to enable us to escape the kill zone, to get off the X. We were not preparing to launch a commando assault, but rather an intelligence mission in a dangerous environment. If that required shooting our way out of a jam, then we would.